Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're restarting. I'm going to be a pain. On your badge, underneath your name, there is a secret letter, and that corresponds to the table. We wanted to make sure that there weren't cliques building up of these activists that would have one table fomenting rebellion by itself, so we've spread them out among everybody's tables. If you'd be so kind, please, as to sit at the table corresponding to the letter underneath your name, that will help us for the next stage. Thank you. I will give you a few minutes to sort out your number and your letter and your table. Thank you. Okay, we're all mastered the alphabet. That's fantastic. 10 out of 10. 26 out of 26. So we have here a bunch of excellent, excellent thinkers. I know, Jordan looks around. Who? What, me? No? Bunch of excellent thinkers representing the New Zealand take on this. And so we have from internet, from artists, from law, pretty much every possible angle up here. So we're going to start. I'll turn them over. They have 5 minutes each, and I don't want to eat into any more of their time. So we'll start with Julian Carver. Julian.
So in many ways, I feel very unqualified to be up here. I know much less about copyright law, internet governance, and creative freedom than anybody else on the panel and probably many people here. And in fact, I never thought I'd be reading copyright law, and I still have no particular interest in it. And with all due respect to my colleagues, I'm kind of annoyed that I have to. My whole career has been based on the internet, or caused by the internet. I was captivated when I first saw it. I founded one of the first web design companies in New Zealand and New Zealand's most successful tourism portal. My work now involves strategy, policy, and projects in the environment sector to enable sharing of data and information. And I'm also focused, as some of you will know, on open data and open government in general. All of this wouldn't be possible without the internet and internet technologies. I even met my wife online in 1995. So my life simply wouldn't be as good without the internet. But I'm also interested in entrepreneurship, startups, commercialization of new technologies from the research sector. And I'm an investor in a healthcare startup and an advisor to a venture capital firm focused on clean technologies. And through that, I'm associated with a film fund involving Richard Taylor from Weta and Panda Screen Productions. And I'm part owner of a new New Zealand film production company. So kind of maybe a foot in both camps. I'm also chairman of the New Zealand Knowledge Management Network, and as such, I'm focused on free and open sharing of knowledge. And I'm also a Quaker, and so I have a strong heritage in integrity and social consciousness in business, and inequality and social justice. So maybe that makes me schizophrenic, but somehow this combination of experiences and values has gotten me concerned, passionate, and upset about ACTA. And here's why. I don't believe people are bad. I believe people's behavior and character can be corrupted and made unjust or made bad by unjust laws and systems of government. Democratic processes have evolved to protect us against this. And humans face a constant paradox, maximizing their success through helping themselves and doing so by doing things that help others and thereby creating a better society as a whole. Martin Luther King said, "Every person must decide whether they will walk in the light of creative altruism or in the darkness of destructive selfishness." And I think this is also true for companies, for industries, and for countries. Is it possible that what we're seeing with ACTA is a small number of rich countries and large companies trying to use laws to tip the balance in their favour? having had their monopolies threatened by the internet, are they trying to change the laws to keep their profits rather than adapting to thrive under a new paradigm? Ante Wessels Foundation for a Free Information Infrastructure said, "Dedicated organisations tend to become champions of their speciality. Strong external checks and balances are needed to counter that. With ACTA, we seem rather to witness a deliberate attempt to create a captive in-crowd." Is it possible that large entertainment companies aren't so much scared about threats to their sales from unauthorised file sharing, but by artists just not needing to sign with them anymore? Are they merely claiming the language of victimhood in the name of their own interests? Cory Doctorow just recently said, "When corporations weaponize copyright to use against civilians, they use artists as human shields." Economic arguments are being used to justify laws that shift the balance of rights from individuals and society as a whole to a small number of corporations and to advantage wealthy countries. But very similar economic arguments, let's remember, were used to justify laws that allowed slavery to those exact same ends. With ACTA, what is the potential collateral damage to access to things like generic medicines, to the development of local creative and ICT industries, and to human and civil rights in developing countries? So, to finish with a plea and another quote, don't let them frame and control the debate. Many times in the information published by our government and by other governments, they've used the term rights holders or right holders. I've even heard it used here a few times today. Don't use that term. Don't individuals have rights too? And are human rights and civil rights more important than copyrights? If they're copyright holders, call them copyright holders. And consider not using the term intellectual property or piracy. Refer to copyrights, trademarks and patents and unauthorized file sharing. And be prepared to debunk arguments that falsely conflate copyright infringement with the counterfeiting of physical goods. Again, don't let them claim the language of victimhood. So to finish with a quote again from Martin Luther King, "History will have to record that the greatest tragedy of this period of social transition was not the strident clamour of the bad people, but the appalling silence of the good people." Let's not let that happen.
Thanks, Julian. Next up, we have Jordan Carter from Internet New Zealand.
Thanks, Nat, and thanks all for being here today. I think this is an interesting event so far, and I hope it carries on like that. I don't have any quotes to read you, I'm afraid, and unfortunately, I'm not a numbers man either, so I'm not going to be able to give you perfect numbers. But I want to make a simple point about why we have a copyright law. Now, I know that ACTA is about more than copyright, but the story I want to tell briefly is easiest to understand with copyright. And the reason that we've got copyright is to maximize the production of copyright works. We want to have, I think the US law uses arts and inventions. You know, want to maximize the production of creative works in the public interest. That is why we have this law. And we provide certain limited exclusive rights to the people who create this content to encourage them to create it. And we provide rights to the public to use this content in a range of ways that aren't always controlled by the creator, because that's the point. The reason we want the work is to maximize, if you like, the knowledge commons that are available to all of us, to seed future innovation, to have a richer cultural life, and to, I guess, become more fully human. And so copyright is a balancing act. It's a balance between this sort of unpleasant necessity in a commercial world of providing economic incentives to create and the rights of the public to make use and to build that commons for all of us. Now, that balance is struck through the copyright laws, and there's this little thing that came along called the internet, and it somewhat changed the way that people can distribute creative works. It allows perfect digital replicas to be created. It allows them to be cheaply transmitted around the world. So, in effect, it has loosened the control that authors have over their copyright works. It has made it easier for them to be distributed. The global commons, if you like, has increased. That's a good thing from the public interest, because we all have access to more material at less cost. Now, the question that we need to work out is whether that easing has led to a supply problem. Because remember, this is about the supply of creative works. Is there a problem that means that we need to change the balance away from what the internet has delivered, a more open and sharing framework, to something else? Is there a need to toughen enforcement? And the only way I think that you could justify toughening enforcement would be to show a supply problem. Because if the supply of creative works continue to grow, if the industries that create these works continue to develop, to create more work, to employ more people, and simultaneously the public could get access to this material more easily, then everyone wins. The industries are growing, the public has access to more content, no one is worse off. So, ACTA is about toughening enforcement. The only way you can justify it is a supply problem. Now, could anyone in the room put their hands up if they are aware of a supply problem with new creative works? Do we have a plunging number of new artists releasing CDs or albums? Do we have a problem with the production and distribution of films? Well, all the evidence I've seen points in exactly the opposite direction. New film releases up from 2,000 to 4,000 a year. New album releases up by a large quantity in the 2000s, when this problem of infringing copyright began. So if you want to change the balance in copyright law, you have to provide some evidence of the problem that you're trying to fix. In nothing that the New Zealand government has published, in nothing that any of the representatives of movie or music publishing in New Zealand have published, in no study that I've been able to find, is there compelling evidence that the economic position of these content-creating industries is in trouble? Quite the opposite. They're growing and they're developing. So if there isn't a problem, don't try and fix it. Understand that copyright is a balance in the public interest, not in the economic interests of the people who currently make a lot of money out of some distribution methods, and that if we're all getting access to more material and more material is being created, that is a good thing, not a bad one. Thank you.
Thanks, Jordan. Next we have Jonathan Penny, who is the Internet New Zealand Cyber Law Fellow at Victoria University.
Thanks a lot, Nat. Well, first of all, I wanted to thank Jordan for inviting me to speak here today in this panel. As the Internet and Zed Senior Research Fellow in Cyber Law at the law school, I guess I have a professional interest in this. I teach Internet law, I lecture in copyright law and intellectual property. But the important thing about something like ACTA is that it has implications for just regular citizens. So we need events like this to get the public engaged, to get people talking more. So I think this is really important to get people other than lawyers and law professors talking about it, so it's great to see such a diverse number of people here today. Now, I'm going to be talking for the 5 minutes that I have on technological protection measures and fair use. Now, we've heard a little bit about this already from Michael already and from Kim, but I think it's a great issue to drill down a little bit further, because I think it provides a great perspective in two ways. First of all, the very fact that technological protection measures are in ACTA, or the leaked drafts that we have in our possession now, tells us a little bit about the problems about the scope of ACTA, and we've already heard a little bit about it. But secondly, it also provides a great window into what I think would be a great vision that we would have for a public ACTA document. I know we're going to be signing the Wellington Declaration at the conclusion of this meeting, and so we also have to provide a positive case. What would we envision to be in a document or in a treaty that recognizes certain things, that encodes the balance that Jordan talks about between copyright holders and the need to protect copyright, but on the other hand, the need to also respect the rights of users to recreate and to innovate and respect remix culture and things like that. So TPMs and fair use say something a little bit about what ACTA is today and why it's a problem, but also about what it maybe ought to be and what it could be if some of the principles we talk about are concluded in the Wellington Declaration are recognized by governments in the negotiations. So first of all, we've heard a lot about ACTA's scope, that this is just an enforcement treaty. And presumably when you have an enforcement, you have people who hold rights, and these are just procedures that are out there to enforce the rights. Now, as any lawyer will tell you, or sorry, any honest lawyer will tell you, the area between substantive rights and procedural rights are very gray. And the anti-circumvention laws that are in the current leaked drafts of ACTA provide an excellent example of that gray area, because what TPMs really are. So maybe we've heard this term thrown around. What exactly is the technological protection measure? Well, they're basically pieces of code or software that are built directly into a copyrighted work used in a digital context. So a few years ago, for example, when you download an iTunes from an Apple website for Apple Store, there were built-in restrictions on the songs to how many times you could copy it. And a lot of people were annoyed by this because it sort of ran up against their own personal views of what would be fair use or personal use with a particular song that they had purchased. And so a technological protection measure is that type of code. It's a great example is digital rights management. That is what iTunes had built into these songs that you were downloading. And what ACTA envisions today is that there are laws that would make it actually tougher laws. In New Zealand, there's already laws that deal with circumvention measures. That is, in New Zealand, it's criminal, for example, if you make or distribute for commercial purposes devices or tools that would circumvent these types of protections. But ACTA has a broader vision, at least what we see today in the documents. It's basically the American DMCA approach to anti-circumvention laws, which is tougher, it's broader, and it's expanded, and hopefully through ACTA, what the countries that are pushing this particular approach, like the United States and various European countries, would have these tougher laws, you know, to be passed by signatory countries, including here in New Zealand. Now, why are TPMs controversial? Because it allows private parties, who are presumably the copyright holders, to make decisions through computer code about fair use, about public domain. So, for example, a copyrighted work that has a TPM, a technological protection measure that restricts its use, over time may pass into the public domain. And so that's controversial because you may not be able to access it because there's a law that says you can't circumvent that protection of the copyright, even though legally you could use the work because it's now passed into the public domain. Or secondly, and more importantly, what I want to focus on is fair use or fair dealing, where you may have an entirely legal and fair use of the copyrighted work, but you can't access it because there is a technological protection measure that prevents you. And there are now laws, which is what ACTA today envisions, that would not allow you to find a device that allows you to circumvent it to have a proper legal use of the copyrighted work. So what are some solutions to this problem? Now, as Professor Weatherall pointed out earlier, there are different versions of the anti-circumvention laws that are in ACTA. The different countries are pitching different ideas, and there are exceptions allowed. And we've heard a lot about framing too. One of the things you notice if you go through ACTA, you always have, of course, very strong and explicit language about enforcing the rights of copyright holders, enforcing intellectual property, enforcing copyright, enforcing trademark. But when we want to look to the other side of the coin, about that balance that Jordan talked about earlier, about the need to respect the rights of copyright users, it's a vague statement about countries may allow for exceptions. It's sort of fair use, and fair dealing is like this sacred word that we can imply it, but delegates dare not speak its name. So what I would propose to deal with this sort of thing. Rather than having a vague, allowable exception where countries may, or signatory countries may, allow for exceptions to anti-circumvention laws, but have in the direct text an explicit recognition of something that is important to recognizing and protecting the balance between users and owners of copyright, of copyrights, and that is explicit recognition of fair use and fair dealing, types of uses of copyrighted work, where you will be okay to circumvent the digital rights management or the technological protection measure, which is restricting your use of the particular right. Now, New Zealand has this sort of model. I'm a bit critical of the New Zealand provisions. I think some of them are onerous, like having to first seek permission and wait for a response from the copyright holder before moving forward and making use of the copyright work, which, in your view, is entirely legal. But it's at least a starting point. But even moving beyond that, and this is coming to the general vision of what public actum might be, so why can't there be, and Kim briefly talked about this, in TRIPS and other copyright agreements, you always have provisions that respect or recognize the need for balance. So why not have a general clause that states nothing in this treaty would delegate from exceptions to, you know, traditional uses or legal uses of copyrighted works, like fair use, like using it for academic purposes, that sort of thing. So a general catch-all clause and having an explicit provision for these types of doctrines. Because ACTA, I think, while we're talking about it often in the negative sense today, it can also be a positive thing if we can influence it. We're very pessimistic about it. Michael's very pessimistic about it this morning. But this would be a great way for us to move forward with some of these types of ideas. Because in the United States, where we have these tougher DMCA provisions for TPMs, one of the ways you can justify it is the fact that in the US, they have a broader approach to fair use. Rather than having just explicit statutory exceptions, there's also discretion for courts to expand uses. And so this is something that may be recognized in the visionary document that will be signed at the end of this. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. And our final speaker is a co-founder of the Creative Freedom Foundation, which many of you in New Zealand know from its fantastic work fighting the Section 92A legislation last year. What you may not know, other than that they are sponsoring the Public Actor After Party, which you can find a flyer on your desk there, is that they have over 20,000 members, half of which are artists. And artists are the missing portion from this morning's discussion. They are why we are here. So please make welcome Bronwyn Holloway-Smith.
Thanks, Nat. So great introduction there, Nat. I've got 5 minutes and I've got 5 proposals to make. Firstly, that copyright is good for both artists and the public. Secondly, that international copyright law is not consistent. Thirdly, that technical protection measures treat artists' fans as criminals. Fourthly, that internet termination is never an appropriate penalty for copyright infringement. And finally, that ACTA will harm artists rather than protect them. So to build on what Jordan has said, and also what John's touched on, firstly, that copyright is good for both artists and the public. Copyright provides creators with rights of control over their work, granting them economical power to encourage them to make more work. As artists, we think this is good. Importantly, however, copyright also carries a default set of public rights, such as fair dealing in New Zealand. This can allow the public to disseminate artistic work and build upon it through critical dialogue. Artists also benefit from these public rights, as many creative works use derivative processes, building upon their predecessors. As artists, we think that these public rights are also good. But international copyright law is not consistent, unfortunately, maybe not unfortunately. Unlike the US, New Zealand doesn't have a parody and satire exception to its copyright law. United States citizens enjoy a greater freedom of expression through fair use, which allows parody and satire as plausible defences for what would normally be deemed copyright infringement. Within New Zealand, it's often the case that similar remixes are illegal, making famous videos such as Telecon, a parody of a telecom ad, illegal. Some of you may be familiar with that video clip. With actors focused on copyright enforcement across borders, the inconsistency between jurisdictions may further impact on these freedoms of speech. While the US's fair use protections enable them to parody New Zealand creative works, we are unable by law to reciprocate. In fact, if we tried, we may well find ourselves targeted by trigger-happy rights holders from abroad for doing so. Greater enforcement of copyright may result in a stifling of artistic and public commentary. This inconsistency is a threat to freedom of speech, something that artists treasure. So secondly, technical protection measures, TPMs, or DRMs, as some people might know them, treat artists' fans as criminals. The Academy Award Best Picture winner, The Hurt Locker, was released in the United States theatres on the 26th of June 2009, and on DVD on the 12th of January 2010. However, the movie wasn't available in New Zealand when it was nominated for the Oscars, or even when it won the Oscar, and in fact it took another month to be released in cinemas in New Zealand. Surely an industry claiming to be adapting and satisfying consumer demand would have released the movie sooner. It's unsustainable to suggest that a New Zealander who legally purchases the US region Hurt Locker DVD and then circumvents its region coding should be as liable for infringement as if they had chosen to download the movie illegally without recognising any copyright whatsoever in the underlying work. Yet this is an example of the approach to copyright the actor represents. TPMs are a vote of no confidence in those who choose to support artists by buying their products, assuming that the intention of those fans is to contribute to illegal file-sharing culture. Making it illegal to break TPMs is a kind of preemptive strike, removing public rights in order to uphold a presumptive yet ill-founded notion of copyright protection and treating artists' fans as criminals. The last time we checked, it was not a good business model. As artists, we want to encourage our fans, not alienate them. My fourth point is that internet termination is never an appropriate penalty for copyright infringement. The US have proposed, as Michael Geist touched on this morning, a notice and takedown model for ACTA, so similar to internet termination, which is something that Section 92A originally included. And it's something that we remain strongly opposed to. Due to New Zealand's geographical isolation, the internet is a vital tool for artists to connect to the rest of the world. To organise international exhibitions, plan tours, or send movie files overseas for time-critical post-production work. It's also becoming more pervasive, with vital services moving online, such as parts of government, healthcare, and social interaction tools, including newspapers, phone, email, and social networks. Disconnection may hinder people's ability to pay bills, operate their business or do their job, access banking, education, insurance, etc. Accordingly, the internet is already a necessary service, like other utilities, such as the phone and postal systems. With internet use continuing to increase, disconnection is a short-sighted and increasingly unfair penalty. Internet termination will inevitably punish many people for the actions of one person on any shared internet connection. This means that organisations such as businesses, farms, schools, libraries, and family homes could have their internet access terminated due to the actions of a single person or even a virus-infected computer. An OECD report said that 25% of computers are infected with viruses. As artists, we see this as an extreme and unfair penalty that should never be an option. And finally, I'd like to put it to you, the ACTA will harm artists rather than protect them. By reducing the rights of New Zealanders that New Zealanders enjoy in respect of copyright material, there is a real risk that actor will actually undermine public support for artists' copyright in their work. A poorly designed regime risks alienating the public to the detriment of artists, as illustrated by the application of the ill-planned DMCA regime in the United States. Unmeritous infringement claims under that regime have undermined rather than strengthened public support for artists' claim of copyright in their work. And those are my points. Thank you.
Fantastic. Any more questions, points, thoughts? Sir, please state your name and then your question.
I'm Taylor. I'm a sort of random person.
Hello. I'm still a random person. Not a question, just a sort of thought, really. I think that focus on three strikes is a bit of a red herring. I think it's focusing on punishment for something which... in the words of Lawrence Lessig, is quite simply insane. Copyright, as it stands at the moment, is completely unworkable, it's completely ridiculous, and I think that focusing on punishment is a red herring for what the real drive of this is, which is secondary liability. What it's about is putting frighteners on ISPs and application developers and so on and so on. So I think what we need to be looking at is whether or not the work once, get paid forever model is a good thing. I don't think it is. And that's my thought. So thank you.
Thank you. Stephen.
Stephen Marshall, Victoria University, in a private capacity this time, though. I think while I agree with the fact that copyright's broken and there are all these big issues that we're conscious of and big risks, I think the worry is that if we just wrote a document that said, or ran arguments that just said, this is a bad idea, it's not good for us, that's not going to be necessarily very compelling in achieving an outcome that we desire. And the outcome we desire is to make this treaty go away, basically, or at least limit its scope dramatically. And the strategy that seems to be being used by groups like the US and Japan in this treaty is that they have got extremely valid issues, so serious problems with counterfeit goods being produced in a large scale to defraud and deceive people. Now, we've already got law about that. It's called passing off, but that's a separate issue. What they've managed to do, though, is have that and then link a whole lot of other things nebulously around it. And so it becomes a bit of a he said, she said about what their real agenda is. I think a stronger strategy would be to say, yes, we agree. Counterfeiting, misrepresentation is harmful. Let's focus on making sure that you have a treaty that just addresses those things. I think it was the point that Kim was essentially making. Trim the focus of the sucker right back to what it really should be addressing. Question why it is, for example, that they're defining intellectual property to include things like undisclosed information and geographical indicators and things like that. By pulling in all of the other forms of IP right at the beginning of this treaty, make the statements very much more specific. And other issues like, why are they talking about linking to things in this treaty? Why are those clauses in there at all? Draw people's attention to those things which are extending the scope of this treaty harmfully, and have a clear strategy, not about arguing the wrongs and rights of international IP law, making this treaty be what it genuinely should be, because that's a strategy that negotiators can actually use.
So it sounded to me like what you're saying is we should, at the very minimum, have a strong statement of what a counterfeiting treaty would cover, and that we support the fight on fake medicines and mass-produced knockoff goods, but also resist the treaty's negotiators' attempt to expand the scope beyond physical counterfeit goods into the digital realm where things get messy. Michael has a rebuttal, and then we have a man at the back who'd like to speak as well. Michael, or a follow-on.
It's not so much a rebuttal, but actually, I mean, the point of trying to limit the scope to counterfeiting, I think, is a good one. And in fact, the European Parliament issued a resolution almost unanimously about 3-4 weeks ago, which one of the statements is to limit the treaty just to counterfeiting. And when asked about it, the lead European Commission negotiator has twice now essentially refused to abide by that resolution. And so there is a second part of the resolution that talks about copyright, and his argument is you have to read this resolution together, both that statement and the other copyright statement, and so it won't be pinned down just to limit to counterfeiting. But I think the strategy is a good one, and in fact it's exactly what some of the members of the European Parliament have tried to do.
Thank you. And gentleman at the back.
Hi. Ooh. Sorry, Peter Dengate Thrush.
Hot mic.
not used to standing up with a microphone. I wanted to begin by thanking Michael for spending time with us rather with your children on the weekend. Thank you very much for that. I have a question right back to the beginning for you. It's a follow-on, I think, to that first question. And I'm here entirely in a private capacity, I suppose. I'm an IP lawyer based in Wellington. The question was, you know, who are the stakeholders behind this? I think a very good first question. The follow-up to that is, you know, we should know who we're dealing with. Why are the countries who have joined this country club doing so? What's in it for them, particularly if they are saying they don't need to change their laws? So is it just to get a friendly group together so they can go and tackle the Pakistans and the others that you mentioned are not inside the club? If that's what it is, let's find out why are they doing this, so if we're going to go and talk to them, we know what their objective is. And the second question really is directed at Jordan, who I thought gave an excellent summary of the crucial issue. If we remember that intellectual property rights are monopolies, and most of the law is opposed to monopolies, and the reason why the special exemption exists in relation to these monopolies is because they are in the public good. I think if you start from that point, as Jordan has done, you get a very clear idea of what the balance is that we need to achieve here. There has to be a balance in sustaining monopolies, which are normally a bad thing, because they are seen to be delivering a benefit. And if the balance changes by means of one of the crucial elements, such as the distribution chain, then it's perfectly legitimate to make sure that the balance gets adjusted somewhere else. The question for me as a lawyer is someone going to do what Kim seems to have done for Australia and go through and actually say, what are the changes to the law in New Zealand that this is going to lead to? Because the suggestions that it's going to criminalise trademarks at the border, we already have that. The suggestion that you can't go and get injunctions against secondary infringers and copyright, we already can do that. A lot of the things that are being people are worried about, to me, already seem at a very rough level to be in our law. You can't do it for patents. You can't get an injunction at the border to stop patent infringing goods, as far as I know, but you can for trademarks and other things. So it would be really helpful to me in analysing this and being helpful, if I can, to know what actual changes to our law at a reasonably detailed level will be. So the question to Jordan is someone in the organisation actually doing a match-up against New Zealand IP provisions? Thanks.
If I could not to step on Jordan's toes, but just to mention that Section 92A is, of course, in process at the moment, and that has included things like and does include currently things like internet termination as a penalty. If things do emerge in the Act of negotiations that require change of law in New Zealand, then that could see changes to Section 92A taking place later on down the track, or at this moment anyway.
Mm-hmm. Just briefly, Peter, we do need that. It isn't underway yet, but we'll probably do it. The complications are the copyright infringing file sharing bill, which may yet change, and the fact that we've only got leaked texts from January. Maybe one of the Europeans will be kind enough to leak the text that's going into this round quite shortly, and then we will have something better to work on. But I think even if we just followed the template that Kim has already helpfully done for Australia and gave it to a lawyer and said, do this for NZ, that would be quite helpful, and I'm going to look at that next week. On the broader issue that was raised by the earlier ones, if I can just take advantage of having the mic, it's a classic political economy problem where a well-organised small group with a lot to lose and lots of money from what it might lose is prosecuting a case through a US trade negotiation system that has some particular characteristics. And Bill Patry from Google has had some interesting things to say about this at a seminar I saw, and that's in his book, The Copyright Wars, where basically the United States Trade Representative Office has good links in with content producing industries and not so good links with platform providing industries, as a gross simplification. And so US sees IP protection strengthening as a key way to protect its own export industries. And given the magnetic desire apparent by many people to have a free trade agreement with the United States, that provides leverage. And I think the other point that John might make is that what this does is it starts to raise global norms for IP enforcement. If they start up with a group of countries who are prepared to give way on that for whatever reason, they will then attempt to propagate that out more broadly around the world over time.
Thanks, Jordan.
My name's Alec Wilson. I'm an independent management consultant. I'd like to bring in a slightly different focus to this and suggest that New Zealand should not support any agreement which disadvantages New Zealand compared with the major countries in the world, and particularly the United States. Now, I'd like to, extend Bronwyn's comments on TPM and zoning. If we were to adopt the ACTA, then TPM becomes a greater problem than it is now, and it puts New Zealand consumers and businesses at a disadvantage because some materials that are available in the United States will not be available or usable in New Zealand.
Thank you. Michael, I think you had something to...
Just to respond to Peter's question, and actually the Europeans did leak a more up-to-date version, given that you're asking for it. There's actually two leaks.
Now, that's great service.
There's the leak text that's consolidated to January. There's also a table that's been released that actually is post-Guadalajara. So if you combine the two, you'd actually get an up-to-date version. They haven't leaked the consolidated version that they developed internally a couple of weeks ago. But Peter asked the question about sort of who's behind it and what's the motivation with the countries. And this is sort of just my own opinion on this is, we can divide up the ACTA partner country, ACTA negotiating countries into three different groups. There are those that are active proponents of it, as primarily the United States, the European Union, and I guess Japan. Then there are those who are there because they see it as relatively costless, because it's probably pretty consistent with what their existing laws are, largely through trade agreements like Australia, Morocco. I mean, if you want, why is Morocco in this? It's because they already have a trade agreement, and this is easy. And the U.S. likes them in there because the ratification number that they've put forward is 5. And so once they get a final agreement, it'll be very helpful to reach that number of 5 to make this an effective treaty by having countries like Morocco on board who can say that we're on side because they've already agreed to all of this through a trade agreement. And then there are a few countries who are basically there to play defense. It's not that they're crazy about it, but they're there because they recognize this will require change and they want to limit that as much as possible. And Canada and New Zealand, I think, are the two most obvious countries there that would require the most amount of change amongst the active negotiating partners. Now, why is all this taking place? To me, this is just an obvious continuation of U.S. trade policy, which for the last 15 years has been very focused on incorporating IP provisions into trade agreements, but it's somewhat inconvenient if you're doing it country by country by country. It takes time to negotiate in Australia or Singapore or elsewhere. Far better to create what is now an international standard and then, or attempt to be an international standard, and then use that with other countries that haven't yet met that standard. I mean, I don't think anybody hides the fact that this is just trade policy. This is an attempt to almost meta trade policy by taking what was typically done on a country by country basis, create a new document that can then be used with large number of other countries and not even have to get into the hassle of negotiating by saying, this has already been agreed to, this is what you have to meet if we're going to have a trade agreement down the road.
Thank you. So to return to the earlier point of Alex, which was he feels that New Zealand should not support an agreement which disadvantages New Zealand relative to the US. And I'm going to put on my ESP hat here, and I am channeling the New Zealand negotiators who say that we are creating advantages for New Zealand exporters of IP. That would probably be their response to that point, which... Alec has a response to Don, and then we'll move back to Alec. Don?
Just two things. One, I can confirm you're challenging. That's exactly what they say. And they say that every exporter is exporting IP, so it's a massive industry. They don't need to measure it. Just on the legal changes, if you are doing analysis, can I suggest that we analyse changes to legislation that has taken place since 2004? I still have... the firm belief, given that certainly in New Zealand, the same people negotiating ACTA on our behalf have also been involved in drafting copyright and patent legislation, that there's a strong tie between those two things. So whilst legislation might have been passed in a preemptive manner, we should measure how that matches up to the provisions that we see coming through now in ACTA. So those claims of no legislation needs to change are kind of bullshit. So...
Excellent. The first swear word was not said by me. I'm very happy about this. Alec, would you, and then welcome other hands as well, plenty of people we haven't heard from.
Nat, I hear what you say as comment from the New Zealand negotiators. I have to say that I have to reject the argument that they put forward unless they also count the cost to the New Zealand consumers of the non-availability of media that is not being released in New Zealand. Now, I know people, people close to me, who download stuff from the internet, probably illegally, almost certainly illegally, not because they won't pay for it, because it's not available in New Zealand.